Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today I am delighted to be speaking once again to Patrick M. Wood, Editor-in-Chief of Technocracy News and Trends, which is the place on the internet to understand and to stay up to date with what is happening in the world as regards technocracy, which is the ideology we've talked about much on this programme, that is increasingly fastening its grip around the globe as we speak, and which therefore deserves to be properly understood and resisted as best we can. And I would say Technocracy News and Trends is the place to go for that, which is www.technocracy.news. Patrick Wood specializes in analyzing trends in economics and politics and the historical analysis of globalism and its elites. He has been an investment advisor since the mid-1970s and co-authored the famous two-volume book with Dr. Anthony Sutton called Trilaterals Over Washington. Welcome back to the show, Pat. It's good to be speaking to you again after 3 years, I think.
Julian, this is indeed a pleasure for me to be with you again.
Oh, thank you very much for saying that. I just cannot believe that it is 3 years since we last spoke. I mean, I genuinely do mean that. The last 3 years have been so packed full of stuff. I mean, my listeners will know, floods, babies, elderly parents, etc., etc. It's just like round the corner and we're speaking again, but it's actually 3 years. Incredible. So it is good to be speaking to you. It's always excellent to speak to you because, of course, your analysis, what's going on in the world, your interpretation of events as this unfolding of this program of technocracy, I find really illuminating. I know that listeners do, and it certainly really helps us to understand many of the trends that are taking place. And of course, we talked about this before, about the history and the nature of technocracy, looking particularly at your previous book, Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. But today we're going to be talking about your latest book, which is a sequel, Technocracy, The Hard Road to World Order, obviously follows that first book, gives a fuller picture, I think, of just how pervasive technocratic thinking has become, how the infrastructure, particularly through so-called green policies, is being constructed for a worryingly controlled and managed future for all of us. So that's what we're going to be talking about. But let's start with a very brief idea of what technocracy is, where it comes from. This is really for the sake of those who have not heard about it yet. And I want to keep this brief, if it's okay with you, because we have talked about this several times before. But for those who do not know, could you possibly summarize for us what technocracy is and where this idea came from?
Well, I can in a nutshell. It started out originally at Columbia University in New York City. That was the bastion of progressive thought at the time in the 1930s. And scientists and engineers at Columbia and some others outside of Columbia got together and decided that since capitalism and free enterprise was about to die, they thought, at the Great Depression, that it was up to them to create a new economic system to save the world. And they did that, and they called it technocracy. It was an economic model. It was not a political model, although it affected the body politic. But it was very specifically an economic system based on resources and resource allocation to be accounted for by energy. In other words, the price-based system was to be completely discarded, supply and demand, those sorts of things. And things were to be accounted for according to the energy that it took to make them. So if you had a pair of shoes, for instance, theoretically, you could figure out how much energy it took to make those shoes, and that would be the price that you'd pay. And they anticipated giving everybody energy scripts at the beginning of a period, like a month or a quarter, that would be allocated to all the people in society, basically just given to them free, and they would be able to buy goods and services according to how many energy script tokens or whatever they had. And it was radical. It's totally radical. They wanted to completely dismiss the entire body of citizen-represented government. They wanted to get rid of Congress. They wanted to get rid of the president, Supreme Court, everything. And they wanted to appoint directly scientists and engineers to run everything. It's like stunning. They never said how they're going to do that. How do you get in America? How do you get Congress just to go home peacefully? I can't imagine that. You know, if somebody walks in and says, "Okay, we're in charge now. You get out. You know, you can't be here anymore." I think there would be a lot of trouble. But they never addressed that issue. How they were going to do it? They just put it out there and said, "This is the way it needs to be," as if somehow magically they would be the Pied Piper and everybody would just follow them because...
And if you say this isn't communism, you say it's not fascism, it's not really a political theory at all, it's an economic theory. I mean, how is it different from communism with scientists and engineers?
Well, let me tell you very pointedly that back in the 1930s, communists hated technocrats, and technocrats hated communists. They were natural-born enemies, and they had nothing in common, and they went out of their way to write vitriolic articles about each other. The reason was this. Communism, Marxism, socialism, all those isms sought to manage the price-based economic system. They never sought to replace it or to displace it. And so even though the economic system was managed by the politicians, technocracy had a complete other idea. They said, no, the price-based system is the evilness here, and we need to get rid of that and replace it with a sustainable resource-based economic system based on accounted for by energy. And so they rejected communism. They said, you guys got it all wrong. You're trying to manage a dead fish, you know, something that's already dead. Your ladder is leaning up on the wrong tree. So there was great animosity between the two, and they argued a lot about it in public, like in letters to the editor and stuff like that. That very same antipathy is still present today, but it appears to me that the Marxist communist elements in the world, we've got a lot of them in America right now, unfortunately, but these Marxist communist elements have turned out to be the useful idiots, if you will, for technocracy, because they are tearing down society, tearing down the existing governmental structure, paving the way for technocracy to move in. That's kind of my theory at this point, but the technocrats that are driving the system, and we can look to the United Nations, we can look to big tech to a certain extent, these people are single-minded in their mission. The United Nations has said pointedly, we want to replace capitalism and free enterprise with sustainable development.
Yes, sustainable development. We'll come to that in a moment, because you actually say that sustainable development is technocracy, and technocracy is sustainable development, which I thought was an amazing phrase, a very surprising phrase. I just wanted to check with you that I've got this understanding right, that technocracy is supposed to be this super rational system. Is it to do with the balancing of needs with resources and allocating everything according to natural resources, human resources, energy resources, etc.? And that artificial intelligence, of course, in the future would be a big part of that. And so that would be conceiving of a system that was almost independent of human decision-making, something that just robotically did the best for everybody. Is that the kind of vision that is there?
Well, you know, of course, back then in the 30s, they didn't have the sophisticated computers that we do today. But the thinking, the mentality was very much that way. They said that they were going to use the scientific method to solve every problem known to man. It was very much, in my opinion, based on scientism. But they didn't acknowledge that at the time. But it was really scientism, because that's what scientism proposes, is that the only truth and the only solutions to anything can be found in science. So they wanted to take a mechanical approach to solving the problems of society and all the problems of distribution of goods and services and work and interpersonal relationships and so on. So by the time 1938 rolled around, their own magazine defined technocracy like this. They said, technocracy is the science of social engineering, the scientific operation of the entire social mechanism to produce and distribute goods and services to the entire population. So you can see the economic flavor in this. It's about goods and services, and it's about the entire population. And this science of social engineering, as they call it, essentially offloads everything onto the science and away from them, because they believe, well, hey, science is cut dried. If science says it's... that's it. You don't have to argue about it. It's not about a personality issue. It's just that's what science says. So you have to do that.
So certainly from a freedom point of view, the removal of freedom in the name of science and engineering, well, how can you argue with that? And yet I do. As a free individual, I certainly do argue with the idea.
Sure.
Now, this idea was kept alive, you say, at Columbia University. And it has flourished in more recent decades, has it not? Now, in your previous book, you pinpointed the role of the Trilateral Commission in being a great proponent of this idea. Of course, Zbigniew Brzezinski being somebody who was a big noise in that organization. Mm-hmm. But another big noise in that organization is Richard Gardner. Mm-hmm. And you have as the subtitle to this new book, The Hard Road to World Order, which is actually an essay by this chap. What's so important about Gardner and this particular essay that you should choose to have that as the subtitle to your book?
Well, there was an academic element back in those days. That's Brzezinski, of course, was an academic at Columbia University. And so the academic members that they recruited to the ranks of the Trilateral Commission, people like Brzezinski and like Richard Gardner, these people gave rationalization to what they intended to do. They were the ones that gave the heady explanations of why it was necessary to create a new international economic order and why it was necessary to, you know, take over the political system in America to try and get a hold of that economic engine that drove the entire planet. Gardner was one of those people, and he wrote this article for Foreign Affairs Magazine, which was the official publication of the Council on Foreign Relations in America, North America. And in this, he proposed kind of the game plan. That's how we took it back then, and that's how I still take it today. Of course, Professor Sutton has passed, but I still take it today that this was really kind of the overall game plan, that they would create this new world order, and it would be a hard road to it, but he concluded what they need to do is have an end run around national sovereignty, not a direct confrontation, but an end run around national sovereignty. And this is exactly what's happened. It's been like death by a thousand cuts over the last 50 years, 45 years. So that's why I chose to get some closure on this with Gardner, because a lot of people have quoted him over the years and quoted this article, but nobody has ever really concluded, what the heck did he mean?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what was he talking about exactly?
Absolutely. That's one of the things that's so fascinating about your book, that you bring these two ideas together. Indeed, the title itself, Technocracy, : The Hard Road to World Order. So There is this end run around national sovereignty, eroding it piece by piece. That's the quote from Richard Gardner. But what for? What's the purpose? Well, according to your book, and it does make sense to me, to bring in a system that goes against the idea of nation states, but which certainly goes in accordance with this ideology of technocracy, to bring in a global technocratic system. Can I just read that quote in full, which you have in your book from Richard Gardner, so that people can go and check this for themselves? It's from Foreign Affairs, Volume 52, Number 3, 1974, pages 557 to 576. And if you go and click on the Foreign Affairs website itself, you will see at least the beginning of the article. You can't read the whole thing unless you subscribe, but never mind. I'm sure there's some other way of finding the rest of it. Anyway, the quote is in there, and it is, quote, in short, the house of world order will have to be built from the bottom up rather than from the top down. It will look like a great booming, buzzing confusion, to use William James' famous description of reality, but an end run around national sovereignty, eroding it piece by piece, will accomplish much more than the old-fashioned frontal assault. End quote. Now, that does look like a prescription to me for action. indeed. But to all of us, it will look like a booming, buzzing confusion, which suggests very heavily that in reality, it won't be. And I find that very fascinating.
Yes, it is. And I constantly get the idea. The phrase booming, buzzing confusion runs through my mind almost every day as I read the news. This is just out of control in America. And as I look across to Europe and I look across to Great Britain, I see the chaos over there, too. Not just the societal craziness, but the political craziness as well. It's just really out of control. And it's totally confusing to people.
And yet, behind it, there are these trends which do, in fact, carry on. There is a certain degree of steering of this confusion, is there not?
Well, yes, there is. And this probably is a good place to interject a thought, order from chaos. This is a satanic, occultic thought that order out of chaos is something that can actually happen. Well, in fact, it can't. But this seems to be the driving thought of the global elite who are pushing this right now, that somehow they're going to regain control of it and they're going to impose their order on top of the chaos that we see today.
Indeed. And one of the main vehicles of this imposing of an order, which we do actually see taking shape today, is the sustainable development. I'll come back to the fact that you call this technocracy is sustainable development. This is your chapter three heading here. It's certainly a phrase that we're very familiar with. It's something we associate with the United Nations, of course, but we don't often think of it in technocratic terms. But you list a number of elements here, which you say are shot through with technocracy. And I'll ask you why in a second. You have sustainable development, of course. You have Agenda 21, 2030 agenda, biodiversity, climate change, alternative energy policy. There they are. I mean, they seem like good things, indeed. We might think they are good things. But you say they are kind of infected by this ideology. So how is that so?
Well, sustainable development is a resource-based economic system. It's not a price-based economic system. They want to completely remove the thought of supply and demand from the public's mind. They want to take away the right to own property. They want to take away the right to move freely, to accumulate property, to have inheritance, those sorts of things. In their mind, this will result in a utopian-like system where all poverty is abolished, where everybody will have housing, where everybody will have employment, and everybody will have dignity, et cetera.
How can you argue with that? It sounds great.
It sounds great, and people are buying it over and over, but they don't realize utopia can never be achieved, never will, never has, and it won't be in the future. So this doctrine of sustainable development is just virtually point by point the same doctrine that the technocrats invented back in the 30s. They wanted to have control over all the resources in North America. Now, it was localized to North America back when it was at Columbia. Today, it's global. It's not just for North America. Today, it's all over the world. This was a purposeful pass of the football, so to speak, when Agenda 21 was created in 1992 at the first Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. That's where the whole concept was popularized. Where that came from, according to the United Nations, is from a book that was written by the Brundtland Commission that was appointed by the UN back in 1983 to study the topic. And the book that was produced out of that task force was Our Common Future. This is what set the stage for Agenda 21 in 1992. And this is widely acknowledged now by the United Nations itself. The author, the principal author of that book, and the person who led the study for those 5 or 6 years was Gro Harlem Brundtland, who was a former prime minister and environmental minister from Europe, but most importantly, she was a member of the Trilateral Commission. So immediately you have to ask the question, well, was she sporting Trilateral Commission policy, or did she just come up with something that had nothing to do with that, and this was all just kind of extracurricular thinking for her? Well, that would be crazy to think that. From my point of view, this was in fact Trilateral Commission policy, and she fed it to the United Nations completely, and they bought it, and the world bought it, and now we have sustainable development everywhere on the planet. All these nations have signed on to the 2030 agenda, to the new urban agenda, to the Paris climate accord. That's where it came from. It was not a broad, wide swath of society that came up with Agenda 21. It was one extremely small, narrow-focused group back in the 1980s, headed by a member of the Trilateral Commission, which had already declared so many times in the 70s that their goal was to create a new international economic system. You just cannot say these dots don't connect. They really do.
Yes, indeed. But there's an element of being difficult to sort of get your head around this, in that there's a mismatch between the goals, say, of 2030 agenda. I mean, when you were saying about this utopianism, I was remembering our previous conversation about this, where I saw a whole list of these goals, which is just about, you know, health and education and for all and water and everything was to be perfection, which, you know, when you look at it, it's difficult to disagree with that. I think, well, yeah, that's where we should indeed be ending up. But the mismatch is very often we will not say to ourselves, well, how do you get there? And yet getting there is this big question, isn't it? Because you say that this is a template for as you say, changing the economics of the world, shifting resources, natural resources, to be taken into effectively UN ownership, redirecting investment, redirecting technology, creating government institutions to technocratic ends, you know, all these engines of supposedly bringing about this utopia. Well, if you start asking about that, the means of getting there, then that actually sounds like control. That sounds like going against the certainly nation state governments of the world. And I wonder whether it gives room for any kind of control for the individual at all. It seems to me like a recipe for just taking over everything in order to produce these utopian effects. And once you start thinking along those lines, it becomes quite scary.
Well, it should too. I think it would be good to point out that back in 1992, for all the members that were present that kind of voted for and discussed Agenda 21, there were many dissenters back in that day. These were people that were formerly, well, probably still were, but, you know, environmentalists and people that had concern for the physical condition of the Earth. And there's reason to have concern about the physical condition of the Earth.
Absolutely.
But yeah. For sure. Yeah,
sure.
Mm-hmm. But two people in particular, I cite this in my book, they were participants in the entire process of the Earth Summit. And they wrote a book in 1994 called The Earth Brokers. And they saw through what was going on at Rio. And this is what they said. This is just an incredible statement. They said, or wrote, we argue that UNCED, that's the United Nations Conference on Economic Development that sponsored the Rio Conference, we argue that UNCED has boosted precisely the type of industrial development that is destructive for the environment, the planet, and its inhabitants. We see how, as a result of UNCED, the rich will get richer, the poor poorer, while more and more of the planet is destroyed in the process.
Yeah.
It's a direct quote. It's like, holy mackerel, they nailed it. There was another young environmentalist, probably about 18 years old. The UN had allowed some young people to just be observers to the whole process, and they couldn't vote on anything or discuss, but they were there, and they got to audit the whole procedure, if you will. And so they asked a couple of these people to stand up and give a speech, you know, at the end of the conference. Hey, what did you think, young people? Are you all on board? You know, you gung-ho on this whole thing? One young lady from Nairobi, who was part of something called the International Youth Environment and Development Network. That sounds like a pretty radical group, right? For sure.
Right.
She made this statement. It's just precious in a way because she saw through it. They saw through it. Young people often can see through things that adults can't. But she wrote, the summit has attempted to involve otherwise powerless people of society in the process. And in fact, they claimed that they were doing that. She goes on, but by observing the process, we now know how undemocratic and untransparent the UN system is. Those of us who have watched the process have said that UNCED has failed. Multinational corporations, the United States, Japan, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, have got away with what they always wanted, carving out a better and more comfortable future for themselves. UNCED has ensured increased domination by those who already have power. Worse still, it has robbed the poor of the little power they had. It has made them victims of a market economy that has thus far threatened our planet. Amidst elaborate cocktails, travailing, and partying, few negotiators realized how critical their decisions are to our generation. By failing to address such fundamental issues as militarism, regulation of transnational corporations, democratization of the international aid agencies, and inequitable terms of trade. This was her last statement. Just before she sat down, she said, my generation has been damned.
Yeah, those are remarkable quotes, both of them. And you'd expect that all this would be sort of shackling the hands of multinational corporations, wouldn't you? Because this is what we tend to think.
It's just the opposite.
Yeah, yes, that's right. I find that remarkable. You have here in your, I don't know which chapter it is, but you have one called the UN's Planetary Troika.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually set out here kind of the mechanics of how this kind of thing can happen. I thought this was revealing, actually. You have the goal set, then the rationale and the action plan. And you have three examples here. I think this is quite useful for people to help to get our heads around quite how this is working. You list, first of all, the UN's 2030 agenda, this kind of utopian mm-hmm. package that we've been talking about, and you say, well, those are the goals. Okay, so that's number one, the goals.
Right.
And then you have the example of the Paris Climate Conference in 2015 as providing the rationale for action. So there you go. What's that? Well, that's to reduce CO2. So you've got the goals, and then you've got this rationale. We've got to reduce CO2, etc. And then you have an action plan, which in this example that you give is Habitat 3, related to this new urban agenda thing. We'll come to that in a moment, no doubt. This is the action plan. This is the thing you've got to do, okay? Mm-hmm. This is to do with planning cities, planning how people live, mm-hmm. planning how resources are used, etc. And this is going to involve all these corporations. Mm-hmm. Just a minute. It's going to involve corporations and public-private partnerships. This sounds like not the world of environmentalism. This sounds like the world of big business hand in hand with big government. This doesn't sound right at all.
That's right. You know, I got the idea for the planetary troika from the United Nations itself.
Right.
I wouldn't have necessarily put it together in exactly the way I wrote it had I not seen in their own literature. They were saying that in order to implement Agenda 21, they said all three of these must be applied together. In other words, they work hand in hand to achieve sustainable development. So I started thinking, well, how is that? It just wasn't immediately obvious to me. But if they said it, I figured, okay, I'll bite. Let's go figure it out. And, and so what I finally found out is these three different conferences were interlocked very intricately to produce an overriding doctrine, if you will, like a supra doctrine that would be effective in driving countries into sustainable development. In other words, it was a coordinated plan by the United Nations to take these three things, they're slightly different, and use them as a single entity to pound their message home. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is something that listeners could understand as a parallel to this or example. Globalization was prospered from ever since Trilateral Commission got started in 73, was prospered by a monetary triad. You had the Bank for International Settlements, you had the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. Those three seemingly unrelated organizations work together in cooperation to open countries up to economic exploitation, like opening a can of sardines.
Right.
They had it down to a science where the three major global financial institutions would go in and do a dog and pony, good cop, bad cop, whatever routine on nation states. And they'd literally just open them up like a can of sardines. They never knew what hit them.
This is the confessions of an economic hitman, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And I've written extensively about this in the past. In fact, I have a little book out right now on global banking from about 12 years ago that I wrote. This is exactly what we found. They worked together. They hunted in a pack. If you were a wolf, right? You hunt in a pack. And this is what the United Nations did with these three different elements that they did in rapid succession. All of these were within, a three-year period. And then they said themselves, this is the package, guys. This is the package that we're going to use to drive sustainable development throughout the world. And it covers 100% of society, by the way, everything. It's the big picture. It's a little picture. It's all the way drilled down to cities. It's drilled into the rural areas. It covers every conceivable aspect of life on planet Earth.
Yes, indeed. And it points in the direction of this new urban agenda. Perhaps you'll tell us more about that in just a second. So this seems to be moving in the direction of cities, which, you know, you wouldn't think that's the answer to this kind of problem, but that seems to be what's posed here. Cities, smart cities. I remember that Michael Shaw, who was on this program, called it the policy of stack 'em and pack 'em. Seem to have added, you've added to that track 'em as well, because you've got all this surveillance that's going on in these cities too. You have a fantastic quote here from an academic journal lamenting the fact that planning has in the past not been controlled well enough. Informal settlements house one quarter of the world's urban population. This means roughly 1 billion urban dwellers live in settlements that have emerged outside of the state's control. So it looks very much as if state control is in view here, and to try and pack everybody into these cities in order for environmental reasons, to reduce CO2, blah, 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 blah. And yet it looks more and more to me like controlling people. So a big part of the central section of your book is to do with these global smart networked cities proposed as a consequence of this new urban agenda. Can you tell us more about that agenda and what's actually proposed here?
Yeah, I can. The whole idea of cities, you can date that back thousands of years. There has been a mystique around cities and big cities in particular, putting people together, compressing people into very dense populations. And today you have a major push all around the world by the global elite to elevate cities as being the centers of power rather than the nation state. That's why there's been a devolution of the nation state all around the world in various forms or another, but you can see the commonality. In Europe, you have the European Union. Somebody will argue, well, yeah, but you still have a border at Switzerland and Germany, and Great Britain does too. And yeah, but okay, so is that just a token, or is that really where the power lies? And of course, in the as far as the EU is concerned, you know, well, yeah, the EU has the power. They're just letting people think that they still have a border. But this movement to devolve the nation state, the constructs of the nation state, is giving way to the rise of global cities. And this is the whole issue with Habitat 3, the new urban agenda. It's to prepare cities for this influx of people that, for whatever reason, they say are coming. They haven't really come that much, as they said, but you know, the predictions haven't come true. But they're trying to drive people into cities with policies that would give them control over those people once they get to the city. It is a mystery. I have to say, it still is a mystery. In China, 3 years ago, a press release was issued from Beijing saying that the Chinese government was going to move 300 million farmers off their land, and they were going to move them into cities. Maybe some of those ghost cities. I don't know. They didn't really say. But in the same breath, they said that they're making way for mechanized farming to come in and take over those all that land. And they're going to have factory farms and get rid of the little farmers, the peasant farmers, and drive them into cities. Well, you say, well, what can a farmer do in a city? You know, they have no skill, no trade. I mean, what do you do with them? I mean, they just die there, and or do they riot, or do they does it turn into a prison for them or what? This kind of mentality we see all around the world, where cities are becoming the focal point of economic activity, not nation states as it used to be. The cities are being viewed as the center of economic activity. And remember
Sorry, I'll say my thoughts in a moment. Carry on.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that one might think that the redirecting of finance for green purposes would have nothing to do with cities. But in fact, if those two ideas go together, then a lot of what we might think of redirection for green purposes, environmental purposes, could actually be investing in cities to get people out of the landscape into these stack 'em and pack 'em cities for supposedly environmental reasons. Quite counterintuitive, but maybe it kind of makes sense from their perspective.
Well, I suppose that it does. The best book that exemplifies this is by a scholar in Singapore by the name of Dr. Parag Khanna. He's dearly beloved by the global elite around the world. He travels constantly, and he's a very brilliant guy, I have to say, kind of like a young Brzezinski. That's the way I look at him.
Right.
And he wrote this book, Connectography, that explains exactly what I'm talking about, that the city now is going to be the focus of economic activity, not the nation state. So you have these city regions that are being set up around the world. And in America, we have like the Silicon Valley area. We have the Southern California area. We have the Houston-Texas corridor in Texas. And people that map this kind of thing have created very intricate maps that show where is the focus and concentration of economic activity as it relates to cities. This is how they intend to create a global supply chain for all the materials, the goods and services moving back and forth and stuff. And they want to get the nation state out of the way because the nation state is a pesky denier, if you will, of economic activity the way they want to do it.
Right.
They have to go through governments. They have rules. They got laws that get in their way. They have to buy permits. They have to have studies done. It's like, guys, if we could just get you out of the way, we'd get right down to business, get this done. So, you know.
So these states, these city states and their areas will have more direct relationships with bodies like the United Nations than they will do with their parent national states, won't they?
Well, that's right. But remember who's driving this process. The United Nations is really just... That's not a straw man. That's the wrong word. But the United Nations is not the people in control of this process.
Yeah.
The global elite are the ones in control of the process, like we heard from the Earth Brokers book. They're the ones that are controlling this. The United Nations is merely just a cover and a rationale for them to do it. Mm. For instance, in the Phoenix area right now, which is a large area, like 4.2 million people here in this area, and I forget, 22 cities, I think, something like that. There's a new regional governance body that's just sprung up here just recently called the Smart City Initiative. And what they're intending to do, this involves university and some other nonprofit organizations, NGOs, not government, no elected people here at all. They're proposing to create an overarching policy for implementing smart city technology in our area across these 22 cities. They think that because all the city councils are going to get in the way of this, you know, with the 5G implementation, all this other technology, the cameras, the sensors and stuff like that, license plate readers, that it'll never get done. So it's up to them to create this regional body outside of constitutional authority completely, but they're just going to dictate to the rest of the cities what's going to happen here. Well, this is an example of how these people work. You know who's behind this? The people that are behind this are companies like NVIDIA, Siemens, GE, you know, all the big players, Microsoft. All these big corporations are driving this, and this is how they get business done. The individual cities are going to be trampled, and they will succumb eventually. They'll succumb to the policies. And they will have nothing to say individually. The cities will have nothing to say about how smart city technology is implemented in their town. They'll just take it and they'll have nothing to say about it.
And I suppose the answer to that will be, well, of course, because that's the rational system. That's the best way it's going to work.
That's right. And you see, when you read the literature that like ASU, Arizona State University, and these other NGOs are putting out, they all reflect back to the United Nations. Right. They make these comments along the way as if to say, well, this isn't just our idea. we have the backing and the authority and the research from the United Nations that this is a good thing. And it's like, no, you don't. It's like the United Nations is nothing.
So it is effectively a corporate takeover.
Yes.
But the corporation understood along technocratic lines.
That's right.
But you have another example of this. Yes. I don't know whether to move on or you want to say something else.
Well, just one thing.
Sure.
I grew up in an agricultural area in California on a farm. Mm. We had some row crops. Some of the farmers in our area grew tomatoes that had to be handpicked. Versus like a wheat field that's harvested by a, you know, mechanical machine. But we had labor, manual labor, that came up on a permit program utilizing what they call green cards, where migrant workers could come up from Mexico, work in the farm fields, and then they would go back home. This happened year after year after year, and the people had to leave their families behind, and they would work in the fields, they'd make some money, they'd take it all back home, and everybody'd be happy to see them again. But the people who did the temporary migration set up labor camps in the farming area. They were never like on a farmer's property per se, but they were labor camps where they would build little shanties and it was just barely functional. You had a place to sleep. You had a mess hall where you could eat and they'd cook food for you and whatever. And the labor camp would be where all the buses went to pick the laborers up, take them out to the right fields and get them back at night to get some more food, get a good night's sleep. And these people worked very hard for that period of time, I have to say, until they went back home. Probably didn't have nearly as much work at home as they did here. So they worked like crazy while they could, and then they went home. But these labor camps, Julian, is what I'm getting at. these labor camps that I saw growing up, and never considered them to be evil, by the way. And I wouldn't necessarily even today consider that an evil thing. It was a good thing for everybody. Everybody came out with something. But this is what's happening with the global city structure. These global cities are looking to me more and more like labor camps for factories and projects that are owned by the global elite. I realize that's kind of a far-fetched, almost, Orwellian thought, but you see policies being put into effect. When people get into the city, they get trapped, and then all of a sudden they're micromanaged. They're surveilled, they're pushed here, they're pushed there, they can't do this, they can't do that. Troublemakers will be ejected, put in prison or whatever. To me, this is probably one of the most disturbing things. And I would hope maybe to write about this in the future specifically. Are the cities really being set up to be labor camps for the global elite?
Yeah, I think it's worth bearing that in mind and being concerned about that. Because for however grandiose these claims may be at achieving all these wonderful outcomes, it can go terribly wrong, can it not?
Yeah.
We need always to keep that in mind. And, you know, you've just hit on something there, which you do bring out very specifically in the book, which is very much connected to this life in the technocratic surveilled city, which is this thing to do with social credit scoring, which already takes place in China. And they have this little list of things here, which is chilling.
Yeah.
Do you pay your debts on time? Are your personal finances in line with your occupation? Have you received tickets for things like jaywalking? Have you criticized or praised the government? Are you a Christian, Muslim, or atheist? Do you hang out with others who have a low social credit scoring? Are you community-oriented or individualistic? Do you do things out of the ordinary observed behavior? I mean, I don't know whether you got those from a particular place, but there's a chilling list. And I can imagine the pressures under surveillance to put people into those various categories, to identify supposed troublemakers, etc. And if you're living in a fishbowl, as you say in one of your chapter headings, you're living in a fishbowl, then you're going to be in that claustrophobic situation and controlled in the name of, well, what? Efficiency in the environment and whatever. So I think that is something very clearly to worry about. It could go, well, would it go wrong, or is that something that's actually intended? I don't know.
Yeah, we'll find out, I guess, one day. Yeah,
indeed.
But
So you were talking about effectively a kind of corporate takeover. Another aspect of this is the public-private partnership, which seems to be achieving the same kind of thing. I have listeners who've asked me particularly to probe you on this point about the P3, as it's called in short. Of course, here in the UK, we have the Private Finance Initiative, same kind of thing. So, you know, the idea of government partnering with private businesses to raise finance for expensive capital projects, etc. And there is this ideology of greater efficiency because you're involving the private sector. And crucially, this idea, of course, that governments will not be raising so much debt, which is a big thing, because they're involved with the private sector who will take on that debt and carry risk, et cetera, et cetera. So you can see from government point of view why in the short term it's an attractive thing to do. But whether it is a good idea in the long term, you certainly have quotes in your book that suggest that studies have been carried out that actually it's not a good thing in the long term at all. Mm-hmm. But very much I get the impression it boils down to a corporate takeover.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
Well, let's go back. You mentioned Economic Hitman before on how the globalization monetary system would take over complete countries, and like, especially in like South America and Africa, where these economic hitmen were sent out to open up a country and to take over a lot of their natural resources and projects and utilities and water projects, etc. And it was very, very successful for the global elite, I have to say. If you just go look at the history of the World Bank and the IMF and the Bank for International Settlements, and you'll see that many, many countries were completely messed up by these people going in and just stomping around and, you know, taking over these projects. Well, when you run out of countries to pillage and plunder, okay, when you've run through all the countries that can possibly be run through, what do you do? Where do you go from there? What's the next plan that you can catch?
You turn to home, yes.
Yeah. And I will suggest it's public-private partnerships. This is a microcosm of the economic hitman thought.
Yeah.
Because who comes out on top in the end? Invariably, it is not the civic entity. For the most part, the private company that comes in to finance some public-private partnership, they get favors from the state, they get favors from the city or the county, whatever, in order to bring their money in, which is just an added little bonus for them. But they end up with control over the project, whatever it is, as part of society. They end up in control of it, dictating to it what will happen. And in the outside case that the project goes south, let's say that they get in, they do something, and they can't perform, they can't fulfill what they said, and the thing turns sour. That happens all the time, too. Who is left with the hubris? The companies walk away, say, sayonara, buddy, we're out of here. And they leave the cities or the counties or whatever with all of the wreckage. And the cities and the citizens end up paying for it twice over, you know, before it's done. And this is happening. This is a United Nations policy, an official United Nations policy. This was not cooked up, you know, by a city or some state somewhere. Oh, we're going to do this public-private partnership thing. This goes straight back to the United Nations just as much as Agenda 21 does.
This reminds me of the banking sector very much, doesn't it? Where you socialize the debt. When they collapse,
what
do you do? Yeah, you just socialize it. This is the big moral hazard thing, isn't it? So it means that the banks can just do all these crazy things because they know they're going to be bailed out. Well, in a similar kind of way, I suppose these corporations can just flex their muscles knowing that if it goes down, well, they'll be okay anyway. They'll be bailed out by people like you and me.
I know. It's a situation where they cannot lose. The companies really that get into these things, they cannot lose because they get all their money up front by and large. They get their favors or tax breaks or right to real estate, stuff like that, all up front. And as they build out a new project, say some new urban development project in a city or something like that, they get their money up front. You know, they sell as much as they can. But maybe after 2, 3, 4, 5 years when they get tired of playing in that city, or the project goes south or whatever, for some reason, they just say, well, there's no reason we shouldn't just walk on this so long. Mm.
So to integrate what we're saying here with the main conversation here, these cities, these mega cities, global cities, are largely financed in this kind of way.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
That is precisely correct.
Now, you have an example of, is it Songdo, the city in South Korea?
Yes, Songdo.
Songdo. Now, that's been financed in that kind of way. I suppose essentially is it an experiment, would you say?
Yes, it is. And there's many experiments like Songdo in South Korea around the world. The fact there's one popping up down here in the Phoenix area is going to be called Belmont. And I believe they've already got a block of land purchased, and they anticipate 200,000 citizens in this Belmont. It was backed primarily originally by Bill Gates, and I think it still is at this point. They haven't broken construction yet, but Bill Gates is the brain behind this smart city from the ground up. And there's several of them around. There's a big one up in Canada that gets written by up in the news a lot. Microsoft and Google is a big player up there. This is in Toronto. And one of the Google subsidiaries, I believe it's called Sidewalk Labs, is creating a community up there that is smart city from the ground up. All this technology is being built in to the very buildings themselves as they grow them up.
Yes. I wanted to throw a thought to you here. People often say that this kind of thing, the partnership between the state and large corporations, is a fascist model, an economic fascist model. I get that. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that traditionally the economic fascist model was that kind of thing, the state and big business hand in hand, so long as big business served the nation, you know, served the people in inverted commas, of course, what the state wanted.
Right.
I see a similar sort of thing here, the state and big business hand in hand, but I'm borrowing an idea from the thinker Sheldon Wolin, who talks about inverted totalitarianism. So this would be the idea that although the state and big business are still hand in hand, it's okay so long as the state increasingly serves big business. It's the other way around. It's still a control mechanism, a control relationship, but it's the big business that's in control rather than the nation state.
Exactly. Fascism, by definition, requires two parties, right? You have the business sector and then you have the government sector. Yeah. What happens if the business sector decides that it doesn't even want government to be in place? It's like, well, what do you call that? It's not really fascism. It's just basically dictatorship by business.
Yeah.
where business is running everything and the government has just been removed. This is what technocracy wanted, even back in the 1930s. There was a book written back then, just as FDR was elected before he was seated, that appealed to him to declare himself dictator to implement technocracy. And they expected him, if he would do that, they expected him to dismiss Congress, dismiss the Supreme Court, dismiss all elected officials throughout the country, and appoint scientists and engineers to run everything. They just expected that. It's like, okay, people say, well, that's just far-fetched. Well, no, it wasn't. Back then, that was reality. That I have a copy of that book, by the way. I had to buy it, found it at a rare bookstore. I couldn't believe it when I read it. But this was their mentality back then. And even though it's not as pronounced, it's kind of shielded or hidden right now. The technocracy movement throughout the world hates government. That's why technocracy has flourished in China, by the way. There's no representative government whatsoever in China. That's what technocracy hates. So in China, when the Politburo all of a sudden is staffed by scientists and engineers, not necessarily by Communist Party members, but scientists and engineers who were intent on engineering society, that no longer is a communist dictatorship. That's simply technocracy from the top down.
Very interesting. Am I right in thinking that David Rockefeller, who of course was a co-founder of the Trilateral Commission, which is central to all this mentality, did he not say he thought that the model of China was rather a good one?
He did.
Yes,
he did.
So.
And he had, I know. And I have to say, China, the Rockefeller family had a very tight love affair with China, going back way into the last century. The Rockefeller family were the primary donors to the Asia Society originally, which has been following China and doing stuff with China, cultural things, for decades and decades. So when China was brought back into the world stage, guess who brought China back in from being literally from being communist dictatorship? It was Zbigniew Brzezinski in like 1976. Brzezinski is credited, hands down, for being the singular negotiating party who brought China back into the world stage. And it was his negotiations with Chairman Deng at that point to normalize relationships with China. Of course, Henry Kissinger had a hand in that too when he's working for Richard Nixon. But Kissinger was also a member of the Trilateral Commission when it came about in 1973. So Brzezinski saw, even back then, and Rockefeller, of course, right at his side, that technocracy was the perfect thing to feed to the Chinese system. And I believe that's exactly what they did. They gave it to them lock, stock, and barrel and said, this is the way you need to do it, and we will help you. When I say we, that would be the Trilateral Commission-connected companies. We will help you build your infrastructure so that you can create a technocrat system in China. And that's what we see has happened now. Over the years since then, this is exactly what's happened.
Smart China. Would that
Smart
be
China.
A reasonable thing to say?
Yes.
I mean, there's a one moment in your book which is amusing, but it's also, again, illuminating, where you talk about the smart city, and you actually say, well, just look a moment what that acronym means. It's specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, timely. And then you say, that's a definition of technocracy. Right there.
It is.
We use this phrase all the time, smart this, smart that, but we don't realize what the undertones are. We're talking about a technocratic reality that is gradually growing underneath us. It's amazing.
Yes, the SMART acronym, which is the best marketing term they ever could have come up with, but the acronym, SMART, is very much a technocrat, a technocrat tool to use in project management. This is what they call it. That's what they call it internally as they try and figure things out. They use SMART as a touchstone. And so when they talk about a smart city, the meaning of that acronym is completely lost. And how they market it is, well, you don't want to live in a dumb city, do you?
No. But I'd like to live in a free city where I can express myself and I can have my opinions, but no, that's not smart, apparently.
Well, it's the same thing with smartphones, with smart grid, controlling energy, you know, smart grid. Well, you don't want a dumb grid, do you? That argument always comes up in various ways, but it's very subtle. But the implication is, if you want to be smart, you have to follow us.
It is clever. I grant that.
Very clever.
Another aspect of your book, which is certainly very interesting, but I would like more clarification on it, is how money fits into this.
Yeah.
You talk about finance and technology. Okay, fintech is how it's often referred to. Tokenization with money. There's a whole aspect of this which I would like your clarification on. So I'll say no more other than, can you unbefuddle me on what you're saying here?
Well, I'll try. The problem with sustainable development today is that it must be financed into existence. The projects that they intend to do cost money, or they cost something, and they have to be financed. The current financial system in the world has no capacity to finance anything at this point. It's a debt bubble waiting to burst, and there's a limit to where central banks can just continue to create money and expect the financial system to stay together. It's at the end of its rope. We see this clarified for us with recent introduction of the Green New Deal here in America. Well, actually, it was started in Great Britain, not here in America originally, back in 2008, actually. I'll give you guys credit where credit is due.
yeah, thanks a lot. Thank you.
But here in America, this new politician, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she has proposed this Green New Deal. She says, well, it's going to cost like $50 trillion or something. She says, we need to retrofit every building in America to be green. And we need to do all these other programs and stuff. And it's going to cost whatever, $50 trillion. I mean, the amount is just in the stratosphere. And the United Nations has said, given different estimates, well, it's going to cost $30 trillion or it's going to cost $100 trillion. And you look at these numbers and your eyeballs just kind of roll around in your head. You don't know, how can I even get a grip on this? But the point is, it's going to cost inordinate amounts of money to make this happen. Mm. The financing system that is being promoted currently to finance sustainable development is collectively called fintech, F-I-N-T-E-C-H. And that's a contraction of the words financial and technology.
Yeah.
And it involves a number of different things. It involves payment systems. It involves cryptocurrencies, blockchain technology, different types of schemes for transfer of money internationally. There's lots of different elements to it. But fintech is the proposed financial savior in the eyes of the United Nations to finance sustainable development. And by and large, this does not anticipate that it's going to be the current crop of currencies that we have around the world. It's not going to be the dollar. It's not going to be the euro. It's not going to be the yuan. It's not going to be the pound or whatever. It's going to be something completely different, most likely digital, because that's what fintech is all about. Right. And that means, when I have said this for years, by the way, I mean, go back 12, 14, 15 years, saying that when currencies finally go, they're all going to go together. It's not the question of, well, the dollar is going to crash because, you know, the euro is going to soar. I've said for a long time that, no, when the institutions, when the global elite get done with currency, the currencies will all go up in flames at the same time. And some kind of a new system will be put into place. So fintech right now is gaining influence all around the world. And cryptocurrencies or blockchain-based currencies are part of that. That's just one. It's a small part, actually, but it's in everybody's mind because everybody's heard about Bitcoin or Ethereum or one of these different coins that are floating around. So the idea of fintech, if you don't have a monetary system that supports the price-based economic system, which that's what the monetary system currently does, it supports a price-based system, then what kind of currency would support sustainable development? That's the question. Well, since sustainable development is a resource-based economic system, then perhaps it would be the resources upon which the monetary system should be built. Not just simply issuing cash for the sake of transactions, but maybe issuing tokenized currency that was based on the underlying so-called natural assets of the world. This is what Earth Dollar is all about. I'll give you an example. Take the rainforest in Brazil. How much is the rainforest worth? Not that we want to tear it down and, you know, sell all the timber, but how much is the rainforest worth? Well, let's say it's worth $3 trillion. And you had the idea, as the Earth Dollar people have had, let's take a big asset like that, because nobody's ever going to tear it down. It's going to be there forever, as far as we know. We want all the trees to give off oxygen, that sort of stuff. So let's take the rainforest in Brazil and let's monetize them with cryptocurrency, the blockchain currency. $3 trillion, poof, just came into existence. Did you catch that, Jillian? I just made $3 trillion in currency. And all of a sudden, it's available for economic activity according to sustainable development, which is all about resources, right? Well, these are precious resources.
But each one of those dollars represents a 3 millionth ownership of the rainforest.
That's right. That's exactly right. And if you take all of the heritage zones across that the United Nations has set up, all the heritage zones in the world, I don't know how many hundreds of millions of acres, but it's a bunch. Earth Dollar says what we're going to do is we're going to take all those heritage zones, which will never be touched because the UN's got them locked up. We're going to take all those heritage zones and we're going to monetize them. We're going to tokenize them. And we will create Earth Dollars that are based on natural capital. Nobody's ever going to touch those things. But nevertheless, that's our reserve. We're going to call that our backing, right? That's like, yes, like it used to be the dollar was backed in gold. The pound was too one time.
I promised to pay the bearer on demand, the sum of, yes, indeed.
That's right. So yeah. So this new currency will come into place and the people are expected to just believe, well, it is backed by assets. After all, it's backed by the rainforest or a heritage zone in Zimbabwe or somewhere. Somebody's got my backing on this. Therefore, this is a stable currency that I can get my hands around. But what they don't realize is this is the financial system that could potentially finance 100% of sustainable development and in the process create the perfect world order of technocracy.
Okay, I have more of an idea of what you're suggesting there. There is, as you say, with the Earth Dollar, there is this precedent for it. Have you read things that suggest that people are really thinking in the terms beyond just the Earth Dollar of what you've just suggested?
Oh, absolutely. Uh-huh. There are several NGOs and several leaders that are openly talking about the concept of natural capital.
Right.
And natural capital, by the way, this is an oxymoron because it has nothing to do with capitalization. Let's say you have a 5-acre property somewhere out in the countryside. You have a nice little home and maybe you have a couple of sheep and maybe a cow or whatever. And you have a pond. And the pond might only be, say, 50 feet across or 100 feet across. Doesn't have to be giant, but environmentalists would come out and look at your pond and say, boy, that's a beautiful pond. This pond has a natural capital value to it that we're going to assign it. We're going to say this pond is worth $5,000. That's the natural capital value of your pond. You say, well, it's just a pond. It's just got water in it. The water in it's only worth $100. It's just my pond. I enjoy it. Say, yes, but this is part of the world. It's just so precious. It's a pond where nature flourishes, where migratory birds have a place to come and set their little bottoms on the water. It has a natural capital value. This is the way these people are looking at the world right now. When they say natural capital, they're talking about all these esoteric features of the planet.
Yes.
I want to say it has nothing to do with the timber, with the mining value of it. It had nothing to do with the farming, agricultural value of it. Natural capital is simply declared because it's part of the ecosystem.
Yeah, I'm finding it difficult to comprehend how this would work because, you know, one of the things that I associate with money, of course, is its rarity value. But this would be the tokenization of virtually everything. Why would anybody want any of this wretched money? Because it would be ubiquitous. Why would anybody cherish and work for it, strive for it, do anything for it?
Because most of it will be in the hands of the global elite, the people we've been talking about.
Right.
Let's say, for example, just in the Phoenix area, let's say that Siemens, the big German tech giant, Siemens comes into Phoenix and says, we want to do smart city stuff here. And the people in the city say, we don't want smart city stuff here. Then Siemens says, you can see this conversation going on, right? We have $1 trillion Earth Dollars in our bank account, and we want to pay them to you to work for us to build smart city in Phoenix. And people are going to go, where do I sign up? I want some of that.
Right.
I want some of that smart money. That's how the economic system is going to flourish. And people will work for whatever they can to get some kind of perceived value out of it. And if the global elite are the ones doing the monetizing, who has all the money?
Yeah.
It's them. Mm. And if they don't allow you to accumulate resources, that means eventually all of the resources end up in their hands and you have nothing to leave to your progeny or to save for a rainy day. You'll be living completely at the mercy of the people who control the system.
Yeah. So the picture then is of these massive entities holding vast amounts of wealth and just letting little trickles through.
Yes.
And so those trickles represent, as far as the normal people are concerned, something of rarity value. So they will. There'll be a little economy going inside the city, as it were. But the vast wealth will be locked up outside the city in these natural resources, which can't be touched apart from whatever this particular corporation might want to do. But nobody else, nobody normal, as it were, can touch any of this.
Yes.
Have I got the picture there? Is that the... Yeah?
You do. Okay. You do. And let me suggest that you also have natural capital value. That is you. Julian has natural capital value yourself, but unfortunately, it's pretty poor because not only are you kind of a nuisance to the planet, you also produce carbon dioxide, which is bad for the planet. And so you kind of start out at a deficit.
Thank you very much.
You're a pretty poor example as far as natural capital is concerned. So the system is automatically kind of skewed against you just because you're alive and you're taking up resources and you're breathing out carbon dioxide in the process, going to create more global warming. And how dare you? You don't get much value all by yourself.
Turn me into biscuits. We're going to be talking about soil and greens here. I can tell.
You said it. I didn't, but you're exactly right. Now, listen, big tech right now in America, I believe also in Europe is happening there too, but big tech in America, we're talking about Amazon, about Google, Twitter, the big giant companies that are control Facebook. These people know that automation and AI, they're displacing workers like crazy. And they are saying, that's not me, they are saying that a new class of people are being created in the world, a class that didn't exist before. We used to talk about the middle class, the lower class, the upper class, that sort of thing. There's a new class of people being formed by technology displacement called the unemployables. Not the unemployed, but the unemployables, those people who cannot be employed for one reason or another. Maybe it's one of those 300 million farmers that get shoved into the cities. They're unemployables. What do you do with this class of unemployables? Because if you do not control them, they're going to riot against you and tear you apart. So here's the answer. Universal basic income. This is being experimented with all over the planet. Universal basic income. Simply give them money. Give them enough to stay alive and to do whatever trivial things that they might be able to do with the money that you give them. Of course, it will just be a pittance.
Or... And I'm only going to throw this thought at you. I have a listener who follows Austrian economics who insists that, having listened to you, insists that entrepreneurialism will find a way to make money. And so, in fact, there won't be a problem with unemployment because there'll always be little businesses popping up here and there.
All I can say is he has not factored in the constructs of technocracy because technocracy completely destroys the free market. Completely destroys it.
Yeah.
And entrepreneurialism depends upon a free market to survive, to do anything.
You can't run your own little business.
That's right. You cannot.
Right. Okay. It's hard to imagine
it is.
Actually living in a society like that. A lot of this is hard to imagine. Yeah. I suppose it is very much futurist kind of thinking, but I think there's a great deal of value to that. And I'm not dissing what you're saying at all by saying that.
Yes.
You are following trajectories which are there, and I think it's very helpful for us to consider those things.
Yes.
But it is hard. It is hard to imagine it.
Well, I don't want – yeah, don't get me wrong. I don't want this to happen.
No, I know you don't. No, absolutely. Sure, exactly. Yeah. The opposite of that. Indeed. And you at the end of the book, the question is asked, isn't it? Is resistance futile? And you say no,
right,
in the sense that – it's the right thing to do to resist in any way we can, even if we're not going to be successful in that.
That's right.
Which I think is an interesting thought, but let me put it back at you. Okay, so if we're not going to be successful, if we're not, isn't there some force to that? Why bother? Even if it's the right thing to do.
I know. You know, I can only say it's because God made us that way in the end of it. Mm. At least for those people who would place any credence in the concept of a God, much less a personal God, who sets the moral standard for mankind and for those who actually have a relationship with him. The whole issue of doing right is just because it's right. It's not because anybody's going to approve of you or whatever. I mean, look at Noah preaching before the flood. How many converts did he get? He got none, except for maybe the eighth that got in the ark. He preached and he got nowhere. He got absolutely nowhere. I wouldn't last for 2 years if it was me.
Noah, yeah, there's a great image.
So, we've seen this throughout history. You know, men of character, men of honor stand up and they do the right thing simply because it's the right thing to do. And many have lost their lives in the process.
Yes.
You know?
So I take the point. Yeah. Yes, it's the right thing to do. I think it's also, I mean, you were suggesting about us having been, you know, obviously created by God. There is the image of God within us as created beings. So it seems like the humanly authentic thing to do. I mean, technocracy seems to be moving in the opposite direction, becoming increasingly inhuman, turning us all into little compliant bods with robots controlling us all. So if we're going to be authentically human, it's not, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, is it so much about the right thing to do or the human thing to do? Perhaps we have to do this in order to express who we are before our creator. Otherwise, we are just becoming little robots ourselves.
Well, that's right. If you worked for a company that was completely crooked, let's say they were given to some dishonest product or something, and you're working there and you're not a crooked guy, but you're working there, and they ask you to do crooked things. Mm. They want you to lie. They want you to misrepresent the customers. They want you to blow smoke at customers and convince them that they're really okay, even though they're going to die next week. There's probably everything's going to work out just fine for them. And you're working for this company, and you say, gee, everybody in the company, except maybe me and another guy, are crooked. Ethically, what do you do with that? Say, well, two things. You either get out or you knuckle under and you become crooked yourself. There's really only two choices, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of people are just going to knuckle under as we go forward. I think a lot of people already have. Mm. They're just going to say, well, that's the way it is. If I want to survive, I'm just going to have to kind of go along with the whole thinking, and I will, and I'll go along to get along.
But do you think there's a hope?
That's not me.
No, not me. It's not me either. No. Mm. But do you think there is nevertheless hope, a real hope that this tide can be stemmed? Or is the very fact that you wrote what you did in your book indication that you think there's no way it's going to change? We're just going to have to be people who do the right thing, do the human thing, and it's going to happen anyway. Or do you think there really is some hope? It can be stopped.
Honestly, I think there is hope until it's proven otherwise. If you go back to World War II and Nazi Germany, just consider the people that lived under Hitler, the Jews and the Christians and other people that got killed off frequently, like the blacks and the gypsies. And those people had a very dim view of the future, I have to say. They must have felt that the world was at an end. You know, this is it.
Yeah.
Because Hitler's going to win, and the world is going to come under this whole thing, and he's going to kill everybody he doesn't like, and that's just going to be the end of it. But it wasn't. And people can discuss why it wasn't. And, you know, there was definitely a role, in my opinion, there was a role that God played in that big time, that it wasn't the end of the world right then. He said, nope, it's not over yet. We're going to have a few more decades or whatever. But when things were hopeless, is my point, there was a sunshine coming up the next day that changed everything. Mankind pulled out of that very, very dark period of time. That could happen again. And I would absolutely say that God will have a hand in that if it happens, because the trajectory right now is going in a bad direction. But if he chooses, on the other hand, to say, no, this, we're just going to let this go. We'll let the world take its course for the Antichrist to appear, you know, during the Revelation period, then this is the kind of system he would take over, by the way. He's not going to be a dictator like Nero was a dictator, but he's going to be the head of a system that has the ability to control the entire planet. So, you know, you could look forward in Bible prophecy and say, yeah, I could see some connections here. Possibly, you know, this could be the end, but it might not be, you know, because we just don't see everything clearly.
Absolutely.
And we just can't dogmatically say, nope, this is it. It's all over. Yes. You might as well just go put boards over your windows and you know, hunker down with your stored food and wait for the end.
You're going to be writing a book, I understand, along these lines, aren't you? This is your next project.
Yes, indeed. I'm hoping to. I'd like to take all of this and relate it to Bible prophecy.
Yes.
I think there's a huge story to tell here. And, well, we'll see if it is or not. I'm going to, you know what? I'm going to write it only because it's the right thing to do.
Oh, very good. Very good.
I may only sell three books.
No, I really want to.
But, you know, it doesn't matter. I'm going to do it because, you know, it is the right thing to do.
I think you'll sell a lot more than that, actually, because that'll be a very fascinating study. And in fact, I'm glad you're going to consider this topic for a book, because this is something that people have asked me and do occasionally still ask me, is that, you know, prophecy set, isn't it? You know, the world system against God is there. You can see it in the book of Revelation particularly, and you've mentioned the Antichrist coming on the scene. So what was the point telling anybody about this, trying to resist anything? Because if prophecy says it is, then, you know, God has set it in stone or whatever they have, how they want to characterize this. And I normally respond, I think, similar to what you've been saying, in that we don't really know the details. We know that there is a destination like that, but we don't know how we get there. Maybe our actions can forestall things. Maybe our actions can make things not as bad at the end as they otherwise would be. We really don't know.
That's right.
I mean, if you're going to investigate all of that, I think that would be actually really helpful for a lot of people. I think it would be a very successful book. I hope you do.
Well, I would hope it is too, but the Christian world at least has some reason to look at this and just consider it. And, you know, if some of it fits for you, fine. If it doesn't, fine. But I think there's going to come a day when some of these things really start to click.
I said on this program before, I do encourage different ways of looking at eschatology. I mean, we tend to settle into camps, don't we, saying, well, this is the right way, this is the right way. But actually, I've said very clearly that I think actually if we have before us different versions of eschatology, different scenarios, then as we begin to see things unfold, we can actually look and say, ah, it looks like one, or it looks like that one. And actually, I think that that kind of education would be a good thing for the church instead of us squabbling about it. So, you know, I think it's excellent that you're thinking in these terms and presenting these ideas for the church, for, and when I say the church, of course, I mean those who believe in Christ.
Right.
Please do write that book. I would be delighted to read it. And I would love to talk to you about it as well. So I do hope it's a serious project that you have in mind. So of course, I'm going to, as we come to the end of this conversation, I'm going to direct people again to your fantastic website, technocracy.news, which used to be August Forecast, August Review, a long time ago now. But you also have a daily podcast now, don't you? Is that technocracy.studio? Never heard of that before. Dot studio, is that?
Well, yeah. That's just another complimentary domain that goes along with technocracy.news. Uh-huh. The podcast is available on that domain, but it's also available if you just go to technocracy.news. You'll see the little panel on the right-hand side has all the current podcasts. I'm doing a daily podcast, though, now. It's kind of fun. Mm-hmm. It's short, 15, 20 minutes, not very long, but I'm reviewing the day's news and giving a little bit of extra commentary. And my hope is that people will just, you know, if they can't read, don't have time, they can at least listen to this and get some semblance of what's going on.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've got Revelation Gate Ministries, which is revelationgate.com. I noticed that you have updated that, haven't you, considerably since we last spoke?
Yes, I have. And I'm moving forward right now to put up my teaching sessions on the Book of Revelation, which I've been doing out here in Tempe, Arizona for the last year and a half. Mm-hmm. And that would be the kind of the repository for that. I'm hoping that people will be able to get over there at some point and start following along with the study of the Book of Revelation. Of course, it brings in a lot of other stuff from the Old Testament, the prophets as well. But it is an exciting study, and I'm just kind of taking time to go through it, not in a rush, but really to kind of explore, you know, the different subtleties and stuff of it. And so far, it's been a great study. I'm really excited to start getting it up on the website now for people to take part in.
Yeah, marvelous. Good. Well, of course, I will put links to all those in the show notes, and I will link, of course, to the book, Technocracy, the Hard Road to World Order. And of course, the previous one, The Trojan Horse, A Global Transformation. Do you have those by any chance as cut price for the two?
Well, actually, let me see. I have price discounts for individual books, like if people buy 5 or 10 or whatever, they can get a discount on that. But I did a Christmas bundle where I had both books for a price, but that has Christmas stuff all over it. So I had to take it down. I couldn't leave it up. People think I'm very strange. But from the UK and from Europe, the best way to buy all of my books is really on Amazon. They have apparently a printing operation over there where they can print locally and deliver to you without going through all the slow boats of China shipping over here.
Yep.
it's very expensive to ship anywhere, even to Canada. It's just ridiculous. But people do buy books occasionally from someplace in Europe, and it costs more to ship it than it does for the book.
Yeah.
So I try and tell people when they can, check out Amazon first before, you know, you come to technocracy.news to buy a single copy.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll put the links in that order. That makes sense. Okay. Well, thank you ever so much indeed, Pat, for coming on the show. Always a delight to speak to you. Always an education to speak to you. And it's a fascinating book. I do recommend it, like I do with both of your books. And I'm going to recommend the one that you haven't even written. How about that?
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to it very much. Thanks ever so much for coming on. It's great to speak to you.
My pleasure. You're entirely welcome.